Hi, I'm Max Bergman.
And I'm Donatien Ruiz.
And this is The Europhile, a podcast where we look at Europe through a Washington lens. Welcome to another episode of The Europhile. Today, we will discuss my recent trip to Ukraine and the passage, finally, of a national security supplemental by the U.S. Congress. Then we will cover some recent incidents of foreign malign influence in European politics. And finally, we will turn to an excellent conversation we had with Ivo Dalder, former U.S. ambassador to NATO, and who is now the chief executive officer of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. We hope you enjoy the show.
Okay, Max, I hear you were in Ukraine fairly recently. Can you tell us a little bit about the context for the trip and what you all saw there?
Yeah, so went on what was a really interesting and fascinating trip. It was a CSIS-led congressional delegation. So CSIS put together the trip, and we had six members of Congress, one senator, and it was bipartisan, so three Republicans, three Democrats. And went to Poland. We were in Warsaw. Then we were at a temporary base that the U.S. has set up along the border with Ukraine that is now, I think, about to be very busy with U.S. military equipment now suddenly coming through. And then we went to not just Kyiv, but we went to Chernihiv, just slightly northeast of Kyiv, to Bucha, and then also to Odessa, and closed the trip out in Moldova. A fascinating week. It was nonstop. And I have a number of different thoughts and takeaways. The main one was that Ukraine is a country that is fully determined, that there was no sense of, well, now is the time that we must sort of negotiate and capitulate because things aren't looking good on the front. There was a real sense of resolve whether or not the U.S. passed a security assistance package or not. But it was a country with a deep sense of unease about what the future holds. It was impossible to plan. We actually, one of our interlocutors said, you know, personally, we don't do any long-term planning because we just don't know how things will evolve. And what he meant by that is they didn't know if he was going to have to pack up his car tomorrow because the Russians were going to break through and suddenly that the front lines would crack. And when you leave Kyiv, what you see is anti-tank steel crosses or hedgehogs that are not, you know, put away in some storage warehouse somewhere, that they are in the medians of the highways and roads that can be put out at a moment's notice. And so this is a country that was desperate for the supplemental aid to pass, for U.S. weapons to continue. One other aspect, the energy situation is becoming increasingly dire in Ukraine. We had a very interesting meeting with the Ukraine energy minister. What is happening now is what we feared was going to happen at the beginning of winter, which is that Russia would target Ukrainian energy infrastructure with intense missile barrages and overwhelm Ukrainian air defense. And that didn't happen in the December, January, during the colder months. And part of the speculation is that perhaps they were waiting for the air defense to exhaust itself. It's now relatively exhausted. And what they're seeing are double tap strikes, which means that there'll be one strike that then hits a power plant or substation, and then workers go to try to repair it and fix it. And then as those workers are working, they get hit with a missile, and there's been casualties resulting from that. But then they're also seeing incredibly sophisticated attacks, you know, 10 missiles at a time overwhelms air defense. And what's really depressing is that probably one of the foremost experts in the world now on Russian missiles and drones and their tactics, techniques, and procedures and how they employ them are not military officials, but the energy officials. And this is really, I think, a pressing concern, because it's not simply that Ukraine's economy rests on having a power sector that is flourishing, but also Ukraine's defense industry, which is producing the missiles and drones that are being used to target Russia and defend Ukrainian territory. You know, they need power to operate. And if you're rationing power, that means you're also rationing your missile and drone production and other munitions. So this is a really critical sector, and one that with the passage of the supplemental, we can talk about that, included importantly the economic assistance, because the economic assistance includes assistance for the power grid. So, you know, part of the trip wasn't just about how important the military aid is, but you really see the other aspects of the assistance being just as critical.
So let's talk about the supplemental. I think it's really interesting how you're describing the interconnectedness of the energy sector and the defense efforts. Also interesting that Russia waited, but the way you describe it kind of makes sense. So now that we have this air defense basically exhausted, how do you see the supplemental helping with this? Because also for numbers for our listeners, the supplemental overall with Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and other partners is $95 billion, but about $61 billion is for Ukraine alone. So what does that entail? And does it help with the air defense piece? And I'd be curious, too, of what that means for the assistance for the power grid, et cetera.
So to break down the supplemental, critically, I think there's about $7 billion in presidential drawdown authority. Now, what's interesting is that's actually half as much as what was authorized for the president to provide in the last fiscal year that expired last October. And that last time it was $14 billion. But $7 billion is still a lot. What that funding is that is the money that you can go and say, hey, U.S. military, open your warehouse doors and take those munitions straight out and send them to Ukraine. That's the stuff that is currently on its way to Ukraine or already in Ukraine right now, because that is basically, you know, munitions straight from the warehouse to the front lines. I like to think of that as a little bit like an IV drip. And we had ripped it out of the Ukrainian arm when we'd stopped providing aid last October. But now we're sticking that IV back in. So there's a lot you can do with $7 billion, because it's also how much is a really old missile or shell. Well, it depreciates in value. So hence the $7 billion actually provides you a lot more in weaponry than what you think in the terms of the number value. The lion's share of the rest of the money for security assistance is essentially going to ramp up U.S. production. So both to backfill the equipment that we're giving away to Ukraine, so essentially is modernizing the U.S. military, but also ramping up things like 155 millimeter production. So we'll see huge amounts of munitions and other armaments going to Ukraine, I think, over the next 9 months, and or at least orders being put in. And so I think this is really going to shift the balance of the conflict is my basic takeaway.
But if, as you said, the lion's share of it is to ramp up production and the window is 9 months, I feel like everything we're hearing right now is the need is acute at this very moment. Is 9 months not too long?
No, that's too long. On the other hand, what will happen is as things come out of production, and things have been coming out of production, this allows the ramp up to occur. Even when we had cut off aid, there were still shipments to Ukraine because orders that were put in 2022, 2023. So what this does is enable the ramp up to happen. There will be lots of weapons flowing over this next year. So IV has been injected effectively, or has been reattached, or I don't know, what is the medical term for inserted into the vein, reinserted into the vein. And so that will allow a lot of weapons to flow fairly quickly. The ramp up in production will allow more weapons to come over the preceding months. And I expect the administration to try to spend down all this money before January of next year in case they're not in office. And I think that will mean that there's going to be a lot of contracts given, a lot of ramp up. And that money is then, you know, that's for equipment, much of it going to Ukraine. And then on the energy side, there's money for the energy sector that will go to helping provide spare parts, replacements, other equipment needed to keep Ukrainian lights on. And there's also money for demining, other things that are critical for economic reconstruction. So clearing fields so that the agricultural production can ramp up. But I think it's also maybe important to talk about how we got here with what happened actually in the House.
This came after weeks.
Months.
I was saying weeks because it felt like weeks of breathless discussion in the media and on the Hill about what is happening. Maybe it's coming back. Because the months before, I think for a while, we all got to the point where we thought, this is not going to happen. This is dead. And primarily for one part of the House, this is just not going to happen. Weeks, though, was like, maybe it's going to happen. Is it going to be one package? Is it going to be four packages? And then finally, it was put forward. How did we get here?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long road. And what I would say is I think a lot of praise has to go around both to Mike Johnson, the administration, on getting this over the line. I do think there's also a degree of criticism. I, for one, had noted back, and I think we've talked about this on the show, like deep skepticism or concern about how this would get through the House back in January of 2023 and wrote an article about it in March of 2023. I think the administration should have not reassured Europe that we were going to get this done because they had no idea that how we were going to get this done. And instead of use the time to really push Europe to ramp up, like where's the European supplemental for Ukraine? I think now is a really important outstanding question.
Well, there are conversations in Brussels now, like what are we doing?
Right. And there really should be because, you know, this money will last, I think, through this year. But what happens if Trump wins and pulls the plug on Ukraine aid? Well, it's too late in January of 2025 for Europe to say, okay, now we're stepping in. No, because you don't have the weapons. You just physically don't have them. So for Europe to step in to replace the United States potentially in 2025, that decision has to happen now. But what, to go back to the question, what happened here was, I think Mike Johnson, when he woke up on October 1st, Kevin McCarthy was Speaker, and I don't think he had any idea that he was going to be Speaker of the House. And I think what the Ukraine issue had become divisive amongst Republicans, in part the Republican primary had started last summer. Donald Trump was, not vocally supportive, very skeptical of Ukraine aid. And so this split happens within the Republican Party. And I think for most American lawmakers, and I think this is maybe difficult for Europeans to really understand, is that, you know, we in this country, every 6 months, there's another foreign policy crisis. So foreign policy crises are sort of the background noise of American news environment. Last 6 months has been Gaza, and that's, you know, I'm not trying to belittle the importance of these crises, but, you know, America is sort of long, far away from a lot of places. And for most members of Congress, Ukraine became a political topic, not one that was about people's lives being on the line. And I think what's happened is over time, Speaker Johnson has suddenly started to get the CIA briefings, the intel briefings, would hear from Ukrainians. There's been a big push and lobbying efforts. Many members of the Republican Party, also Democrats. And I think there's been a sense that politically this would be a loser for Republicans if they were to actually not provide aid to Ukraine, and the sense of crisis in Ukraine. So it became incredibly urgent that this happened. And that all sort of built up. And I think in the end, Mike Johnson decided that it was worth risking his speakership over Ukraine aid. And I have to say, I lost a bet with our colleague Elizabeth Hoffman, who runs our congressional affairs team, because I thought the discharge petition was how this was going to get done. And everyone has become sort of knowledgeable of this arcane congressional procedure. But it was essentially what would enable Johnson to get Ukraine funding passed without him having endorsed it. And instead, what he did is just said, I support Ukraine aid, and brought to the floor a bill that was vehemently opposed by large swaths of the Republican Congress. And in fact, it's important to note the Ukraine funding did not get the majority of the majority. The majority of Republicans opposed it. And so that's usually a no-no for the speaker. And he had to rely on Democratic votes to get the rules done for how the voting would take place. So incredibly dramatic, actually, period on Capitol Hill, where essentially Mike Johnson is risking his tenure as Speaker of the House over Ukraine aid. And I think a lot of Democrats and progressives have sort of said, well, you know, he held on for 6 months. He and that has been of dire consequences to Ukraine. And that is 100% true. But yet he ultimately got there and made, I think, a very brave political decision, something that you just don't really see in Washington, particularly in an election year in which Donald Trump is sort of not clear where he would go. And Mike Johnson met with Donald Trump before, but there was not like a clear endorsement from Trump. The Congress is in recess this week. But when he comes back, he may face a challenge, a motion to vacate, which could mean the end of his speakership, depending on what Republicans do and what Democrats do. So it's a very interesting dynamic.
Well, first of all, that is the nerdiest bet I've ever heard of. Which way is the bill going to get to the
this
floor?
This is what we do in D.C.
Especially in this building. Yeah. But for Johnson, I think it's also he needed time to be okay with the fact that it might cost him his job. It's also someone who was never supposed to be speaker. So maybe that helped in a way, because it's not like he's had a lifelong ambition to be speaker. It just happened to him. And it takes a while, actually, coming into the speakership with no clear allies and a network and being able to be a good fundraiser is usually what gets you to be speaker and stay speaker. He didn't have any of that. He didn't know how to play the game, and it took him, 6 months is a long time, but I think that's what it takes to figure out, okay, which way can I maneuver? What's going to kill my speakership? What am I okay with? And it took that time.
No, and he had the weight of Ukraine on his shoulders. And I think that really impactful and significant. And I think the White House also deserves credit in how it went about engaging him, cultivating. They didn't attack him. You know, I think they would have. It would have been really vicious if, rightfully so politically, if he decided not to have moved Ukraine aid forward. But maybe let's turn to, you know, Europe is about to have really important elections, and there's all sorts of concerns about Russian Chinese interference, not just ahead of these elections, but in Europe right now.
This has been brewing for a while, but has really exploded in the last few weeks. There's several spying scandals and stories of espionage, and it feels very Cold War-y, because I think in some ways it is. But across multiple countries, there's been stories coming out of people are arrested for spying for Russia, for China, sharing information, but also really worryingly planning attacks on some targets, for example, U.S. bases in Germany, things like that. That's really erupting on the scene in Europe. So just to give a couple examples, in Germany, the MEP who is at the top of the AfD's list, the far-right party in Germany, has been accused of being close to the Russian government, let's say. One of his top aides has recently been accused of spying for China. So that's not a great record going into an election, let's say, in the middle of a war currently being waged by Russia in Europe. And there's a lot of conversations within the AfD of should he drop out of the list. So far, he's not been pushed out. He's still a top candidate for the party. So, and the AfD was meant to do really well in the election. So it could really impact their performance, depending on how voters see this. There's been some other instances in the UK, for example. Obviously, they're not going to the EU elections because they are not in the EU anymore. But between 2021 and last year, there were two people were charged for handing over documents to China. We've seen in the Czech Republic, Voice of Europe is an outlet that's been accused of just sharing pure Russian propaganda. The Czech government has been very forward-leaning on wanting to take very strong measures for this. So, for example, including Voice of Europe in the next sanctions package. And Voice of Europe is a really smartly picked name, I gotta say, because Voice of America is a real thing. Voice of Europe, not so much. And that's very confusing, I think, for news consumers. The Czech Republic has also floated a proposal to curb freedom of movement within the Schengen area for some Russian diplomats who are suspected of being spies. There's some concerns about that. But I remember when we were doing research for the second Kremlin playbook in the Czech Republic, was a case study. We interviewed someone in the Interior Ministry who said that the Russian embassy in Prague is unusually large. I think it's been obviously depleted since the war, the full-blown war in Ukraine, because a lot of diplomats have been expelled from a lot of embassies. But it's not a big country, and that embassy was huge. So it just gives you a sense, and then obviously Vienna is still like massive espionage center. So there's a lot going on with more aggressive tactics from Russian spies, the use of new technology, of social media, about a month and a couple weeks away from the EU Parliament elections.
The problem of foreign influence into European elections, I think, is particularly acute in part because European elections are regulated, right? And this, I think, is generally a very good thing, that there's limits on how much parties can spend. It's all supposed to be very transparent. So what that means is that if there's outside money coming in, it can actually have a very impactful distortive effect. I think it can have an effect on our elections too in the US, but we have this sort of free for all in terms of just, you know, unlimited amounts of funding are pouring in. So it's sort of harder to have that distortive impact. But, and there's also been amazing past scandals. I really encourage everyone to go look at the Ibiza Austrian Freedom Party scandal, where, you know, just before the European elections, a video was revealed of someone pretending to be the niece of a Russian oligarch, essentially entrapped the two leaders of the Austrian Freedom Party. No one really knows who was behind this video. I think it was
We still don't. Yeah, I think
I have my conspiracy theories that we can talk about not on air, but it came out right before the European elections in some ways, and it brought down the Austrian government. But what that video showed is how kind of normal it was seeming for certain politicians to be dappling in Russian money. And Salvini in Italy, as also people connected to him have been caught on tape in a similar situation. So I think this is what's interesting to me is this strikes me as the EU on offense, and Macron in particular, who's someone who's a victim of Russia interfering in his campaign. Everyone forgets about that. But trying to sort of go on offense and be on the front foot at trying to combat some of these foreign interference.
Well, the Austria example is also a reminder that when you see pictures of the European Parliament, it looks grand and this big structure and really serious looking MEPs. But these are very parochial elections because they're national. I mean, they're for the European Parliament, but they happen at the national level. And some of these candidates are on the list because they couldn't make the national list. And so they're kind of like the reject for some of the parties, or they're just late in their career. And so that's the backup plan. And so there's not a lot of attention paid to this. And therefore, they think that, you know, who knows who's going to know that I took this bribe here or anything there. And there's actually an investigation by Belgian law enforcement into bribes to some MEPs, including things like appointing employees to certain MEPs who are pro-Russian, also sharing pro-Russian narratives. So we should be very clear, it doesn't automatically translate into Russia-friendly policies from all of these MEPs. Impact is much harder to track than the input for the election, but that's something to keep an eye on. And you were saying the EU is really forward-leaning on this. There's currently talk of activating a temporary crisis mechanism that's called the Integrated Political Crises Response that the rotating presidency can really use to centralize monitoring, sharing information also to national bodies and law enforcement so that they can move forward on any real concerns.
It's sort of also the awakening that European elections actually matter, and that if you influence members of the European Parliament, it actually may have more impacting stuff at the European level, not just at the national level. And we've seen this in other corruption scandals that have emerged in Brussels over the last couple of years. I think we'll have to leave it at that. Let me say also thank you to Otto Svensson for stepping in for our last episode. And the interview that we are about to listen to with Ivo Dalder actually backs up some of what Otto said last episode about NATO coming forward with its 100 billion euro proposal and how, you know, in Ambassador Dalder's view, that was really as a way of countering what they're hearing from Brussels about Eurobonds and NATO, you know, kind of playing its typical bureaucratic game, which the EU also plays with NATO itself. But it's a great interview, and give it a listen.
We are thrilled to be joined by Ivo Dalder. Ambassador Dalder is the Chief Executive Officer of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He first joined the Council as President in 2013 after serving as U.S. Ambassador to NATO under President Barack Obama. Prior to his appointment as Ambassador to NATO, he was a Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution, specializing in American foreign policy, European security and transatlantic relations, and national security affairs. Ambassador Dalder is the author and editor of 10 books, including The Empty Throne, America's Abdication of Global Leadership, with James Lindsay. Ambassador Dalder, welcome to the Eurofile.
Hey, great to be here.
Why don't we start with the usual elephant in the room, which is, of course, the war in Ukraine. You've written a lot about this over the past 2 years since the war broke out. I'd like to start with U.S. military support, because Max and I talk about this a lot. In 2023, you wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs talking about the fact that this was very likely to be a prolonged war. I think we're all looking at this thinking, probably about accurate. So I'd be curious first for your assessment of this now that we're just over 2 years out from the beginning of this invasion, your thoughts on the prospects for U.S. assistance, given the reality on the ground, but also the realities in Congress.
I think the war is in a very precarious stage. I think the worries that you're hearing coming from Kyiv senior leaders, including senior military leaders, are real. I think there are sort of four big factors that are influencing the current assessment in a negative way. One is manpower. The Russians have a significant advantage in manpower. The mobilization effort that the Ukrainians needed to start is starting too late. The reduction from 27 to 25 for conscription, it should have happened a long time ago. I think the number of forces they need may not be 500,000, but it's certainly more than 300,000. It's closer to 400,000. It's not clear that the Ukrainian system is actually capable of pushing that number through in terms of training and everything that needs to happen. Right now, they do about 12,000 a month. If you triple it, it's not clear the system can do that. So there's a manpower issue. It's just real fundamental. Second issue is that their defensive preparations, which are now finally really taken off, the in-depth preparations to hold advancing forces also started very late, but they are starting, and they're starting up in the right kind of way. But, and this is a big but, it's not clear that they have plans that are coordinated with the defensive fortifications that they're building. So it's all good to have defensive fortifications, but if you don't have a plan for addressing and your firepower in those areas in which they are being choked into, then it doesn't matter as much. And the Russians clearly did have that. It's one of the reasons the offensive last summer didn't work. Third is morale. Not only is morale declining on the Ukrainian side, and you're seeing questions of desertion, people leaving, etc., but it's very hard to fight in the environment in which they're fighting. More worrisome is that Russian morale's up. That means they're willing to take bigger risks. So one of the ways in this war has really evolved and last since winter, I think, is the use of Russian air power and glide bombs. And pilots who were not willing to take the risks because they thought they would be shot down are now willing to take the risks, and they're therefore more effective. And then finally, and this is the fourth reason, is they're running out of stuff. The third one is related to that. The manpower and defensive fortification has nothing to do with stuff. Has to do with what the Ukrainians need to do. And if they had more artillery shells and more capabilities, if they don't have the manpower and they don't have the defensive fortifications, it's not going to be as effective as they otherwise would be. There's no doubt that that they have consumed large quantities and the backfilling hasn't happened. Remember that the United States, that the Biden administration asked for a plus up on the FY23 supplemental back in August. Since August, the need has existed without funding coming through. Literally until this week, I thought the chance of a passage was close to zero on aid. I am now actually much more optimistic because I think what has changed is, one, the realization that the situation in Ukraine is dire. And I think a number of Republicans have made clear to the Speaker that if he doesn't put a package on the floor, they will do a discharge petition. They will sign a discharge petition, and they will get the Senate package on the floor. I think actually that's still the most likely thing to happen, because I don't think that the Speaker has been too clever by half. He's known all along that there needs to be a vote. And if there is a vote, he's risking his speakership. And the whole reason he hasn't done anything since February 13th when the package came over is in order to save his speakership, but it doesn't matter. Because he's either going to be survived because Democrats vote for it, and they have indicated as of February 13 that they were willing to do that, or he doesn't survive, or he calls Marjorie Taylor Greene's bluff and, fine, and he does survive. But nothing has changed since February 13, and it hasn't changed now. The only thing that has changed is that sufficient number of Republicans have indicated that one way or another there's going to be a package and it's going to go through. So I'm now much more optimistic on that front. I worry it is too late. I worry that the package itself may not be enough for the Ukrainians to stabilize the situation. More confident on the air war. So I do think that the kinds of missile defense interceptors that we now will be able to send in short order will be able to deal more effectively with particularly the missile threat to cities, but also hopefully with the German initiative to push for more air defense capabilities. It may affect the front line. But I worry that all the other factors are still there, and it's going to be a problem.
I should mention we're recording on Thursday, April 18th. So we'll see what happens this weekend. There's supposed to be votes in the House on Ukraine aid, Israel, Taiwan, and then also sort of a grab bag of other issues. And then once that passes, it will have to go to the Senate. The Senate should be able to, I think, approve what the House puts forth. Then the aid can start flowing. But I think you're right, Ivo. There's a real question of is it too late? I was in Ukraine about a little more than a week ago. It was clearly a country that was on edge. You know, if you drive outside of Kyiv, you still see all the steel anti-tank structures, and they're in the median of the roads. They're not sort of taken off to a depot somewhere. They're ready to be put in at a moment's notice. And I think that there's a degree of Ukraine was preparing to go on the offensive, not really preparing for the defensive. And they've been scrambling over the last 6 months. But I want to maybe switch gears a little bit to talk about the upcoming NATO summit and how Ukraine can be treated or how Ukraine is going to figure into that summit. And then maybe we'll go on to talk about the rest of the issues with the summit. But maybe we could stick with the Ukraine portion because it strikes me as quite tricky that if Ukraine is holding on by a thread, it seems a little incongruous to be talking about Ukraine membership when we're really talking about Ukraine survival at this point. But I'm curious for your thoughts. I know you just had a piece with former Assistant Secretary for Europe, Karen Donfried, in Foreign Affairs. We'll put it in the show notes. But maybe you could outline your view on what needs to happen when it comes to Ukraine and NATO membership.
I mean, I think my views have evolved since even that piece was published on March 26th. I think the situation in Ukraine in July will be dire. And that's even assuming the package gets through. If the package doesn't get through, it will be, it's guaranteed to be extremely dire. Because without more artillery and other things, it's just really going to be problematical. I think this summit is likely to be very much like the last time there was a summit in Washington, which was also an anniversary year, 1999. It was the 50th anniversary, where everybody came together believing that they would be celebrating the first enlargement of NATO since 1982, when Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary joined just weeks before the summit took place in Washington. But the entire discussion was about Kosovo. NATO had launched a major air campaign deal with Serbian ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, and the air campaign was not. Everybody thought it was going to be over very quickly, and it turned out it wasn't going to be over very quickly. And there was a very serious debate about what more NATO could do, including the question of whether it should consider a ground invasion. And Tony Blair, who was then the UK Prime Minister, had given a speech in Chicago, of all places, outlining the urgency of rethinking humanitarian intervention, and had spent the day before the summit in the Oval Office trying to convince Bill Clinton that they needed to do some serious planning on the ground invasion. Clinton wasn't prepared to do it, but NATO started planning for a ground invasion. And the seriousness with which NATO discussed this issue may have actually had an influence on Boris Yeltsin and the Russians, who then became involved and started to help find a way to end the conflict, which few weeks later, it did. I recount that story that I think the current planning, which is sort of, we're going to talk about how NATO will be more involved in helping Ukraine's future force and maybe take over the Rammstein coalition, etc. And we can sort of avoid another fight over NATO invitation, which is the current way that I think people are seeing is likely to be overtaken. And I think we're going to have a debate about what more we can do to make sure that Ukraine doesn't lose the war. And I think a number of Europeans will come with the same argument they did in 1999 and say, this is existential for NATO. This is actually an Article 5. They won't call it that. But Ukraine losing, as now it seems is a real prospect, is a fundamental threat to European security and to NATO's credibility. And that therefore we need to do everything possible to make sure Ukraine doesn't lose. And the debate will be what is that? Is it different kinds of weapons? Is it Taurus and ATACMS and all that kind of thing? That's one thing. And second, because it is a serious discussion in certain countries, it's about direct support. You know, it's not just Macron who's been talking about it. The Finns have been talking about it. The Balts are talking about it. And the big thing that changed besides. Huge thing that changed, besides the perilous state of Ukrainians standing in the war, is what happened over the weekend, when the United States, the UK, and France actively and decisively intervened in protecting Israel from an Iranian missile attack and put on the table very directly the question, if you're doing it for Israel, why can't you do it for Ukraine? It's a real fundamental question. And I think you will also have a number of countries say, wait a minute, you're prepared to give Saudi Arabia an Article 5 security guarantee, but you're not willing to do this for Ukraine. So I think there's going to be a real debate. And the administration, you know, rightly, because it has an election, doesn't want to have that debate. It wants to avoid it. But, you know, events, dear boy, events may force the administration to, you know, all of us to have this debate. So I think this summit is likely to be hijacked by Ukraine, but not in the way we've been thinking, which is membership and all that. No, it's about what are we going to do as a military alliance to make sure that Ukraine does not lose this war, because it is losing this war right now.
And I think when I think about this summit, it strikes me as probably one of the most political summits, perhaps in the history of NATO. It's going to happen 4 days before the Republican convention. Donald Trump, the presumed nominee, has thoughts on his skepticism of NATO, I think, is well understood. But it also strikes me as a real challenge for the alliance. So you've been in these rooms and part of, you know, preparing for summits, that the what's actually on the kind of NATO agenda here was effectively implementing the plans that were agreed to last year, which were, you know, about the strategic concept that was in Madrid that was agreed to in 2022, about basically focusing on Russia. And this is sort of a summit that's about sort of checking up on implementation. In some ways, this seems sort of quite technocratic to me. And I'm curious how you think of this summit. So if we maybe put Ukraine to the side, and I think what you're saying is we're not going to be able to, but is there enough here at the kind of agenda that will really highlight NATO in a positive way to the American public? And or is this just going to be sort of a photo op with the president looking like a world leader and really being taken over by kind of the political side of the White House?
I mean, it'll be a photo op because that's what it is. What some do is they're forcing mechanisms. They force bureaucracies and coalitions and in multinational groupings to get stuff done in the time so it can be highlighted at the summit. And, it, you know, lots of things get solved in that process. That will be sufficient. But the big theme, you know, leaving Ukraine aside, but it's actually relevant to it, that this implementation of the decisions of the Madrid and Vilnius summit and sort of checking on progress is the consolidation of NATO's own perspective of its own role, which is a return to deterrence and defense against primarily a threat from the East, Russia. There are others who are worried about southern instability, and people will talk about this. For sure, there will be attention paid to what's happening in the Middle East and how that affects NATO security. But fundamentally, this is a summit in which NATO says we are firmly back into our core business. And we kind of did that with the strategic concept, but that was overtaken by Ukraine. That was the only thing. And of course, Vilnius was only about Ukraine and the fact that Zelensky blew it up when he tweeted out his displeasure on that he wasn't going to get an invitation and the language expressing that. We actually haven't had a summit that tells the American people and the people in Europe that this is the way in which we keep Europe and therefore the United States secure. It is a huge opportunity for the administration, for people who care about NATO, to make the case about how fundamental a strong and capable Europe is to America's security. And it is a case where you take the win on the burden sharing side, which is real, because Europe is now spending 2% of GDP on defense collectively. You take that win and say, and it's actually very serious about defense, and that includes the Germans, it includes everybody else, and say, and the reason is because they're afraid of the Russians. Not because we told them to, and that's the Trump mantra, no. Because they understand that military security is fundamental to their security. If NATO succeeds in its core mission, we, the United States, benefit greatly because a war in Europe means a war that we are involved in. Whether we're members of NATO or not, it's just what happened in World War I and World War II. And we don't want a war in Europe. And NATO has, for 75 years, been the instrument to prevent that from happening. That's also the framework why, you know, if that things happen badly in Ukraine, that same argument will be therefore have to be translated to Ukraine. And if there's a debate, that's the debate. But it is the opportunity to say, wait a minute, let's remember what this is about. It's about our security. I did a piece in Politico, in my column that I did a week or so ago, where I argued alliances aren't about dollars and cents. They're about security. And it doesn't matter so much. Yes, it's important that they spend, etc. That's not what this is alliance about. It's about the idea, the understanding that if Europe is secure, we are secure. That if Europe is prosperous, we are prosperous. That if Europe is free, we are free. And the opposite is also true. If Europe is insecure, we are insecure. And if Europe is failing economically for whatever reason, we will have a negative impact economically. And if Europe is unfree, we will be unfree. And that's what this alliance is about. And that's what you can highlight in the 75th anniversary and not get dragged into where we have gotten the alliance drug into, which is how much is it spending on defense? Because frankly, that isn't the issue. This is the Trumpification of NATO. Let's talk about the NATOification of NATO, which is about security, not about spending.
You mentioned a strong and capable Europe, and I think the summit is a big discussion in transatlantic security circles. Another huge area of conversation, especially here on this podcast, but also just across a range of actors, is the Europe piece in all of this, in Europe's push for its own security. As you said, there's a clear realization that this is really important. Europeans have to step up, not just because, as you said, an American president is asking them to do this, but really because it's important for their own security and defense. And a big area of growth for this is to have the European Union be a more prominent actor in this space. There's a lot of conversation, obviously, with the 100 billion euros investment in defense, having a defense commissioner, but also having Europe, the EU in particular, be more involved in coordinating weapons procurement, etc. I'm curious for your take on the potential for more EU-NATO cooperation in a framework that moves away from the usual US concerns around duplication, or maybe you share those concerns.
No, I don't share those concerns. I actually think that that's an old debate, the EU-NATO debate. I think what's happening is that there is a role for the EU. It is primarily in the production and defense industry side in terms of encouraging coordination. If Europe wants to be serious about having its own defense capabilities, it will lead to the consolidation of defense industries and cooperation, etc. And the EU is the framework for doing that. And I think the reason to have a defense commissioner is to focus that effort. How do you Europeanize defense production? And 100 billion, which by the way doesn't exist, it's made up by Commissioner Breton, just like the 100 billion that Jens Stoltenberg promised for Ukraine doesn't exist. In fact, the only reason he had 100 billion is because the EU had 100 billion, which tells you how this game is being played in Brussels between AFID, where NATO is, and downtown, where the US, the EU is, just as a sidebar for us EU NATO Knicks. It's all a joke. It's not real. But the defense commissioner stuff is real, and the need for the Europeans to consolidate their defense industries and to get serious about defense production is very real, and it's good that the Europeans are starting to focus on that, but not defense policy. Defense policy is not going to go to the EU, and even the French now understand that you can't do it in the EU, that building the institutions not only is duplicative, they just don't exist, so you'd have to build them out of scratch, and they have a wonderful institution that in fact does exist, that is incredibly capable, and it's called NATO. And so the thrust of European thinking is moving towards the Europeanization of NATO. And the thrust of American thinking should, but it hasn't yet moved, to how does the United States encourage the Europeanization of NATO, rather than stop it. And that means we need to make some big decisions, including the decision that if we want the Europeans to take on more responsibility, we need to encourage them to do that by us taking less responsibility. And maybe we don't win every argument. And maybe they sometimes do things differently than we do, and that's okay. Because wouldn't it be good, just to take it down to a very tactical level, that in the Combined Air Operations Centers, the COCs, in NATO or at Rammstein, that there are more European officers to be able to man and staff the integrated air defense system, or to be able to target and do the planning for an air operation. And the problem that the French found and the Brits found in 2011, when they were started, you know, the campaign against Libya outside of NATO, is they didn't know how to do it. Only the U.S. could do it. And when the U.S. said, well, we're no longer doing it, we're handing off the responsibility, they had to go to NATO. And then they found out that in NATO, except for a few Germans, by the way, they didn't have the capability except what the U.S. was providing in terms of the chaos. The air defense was not important because Libya didn't have an air force, or not as important, at least. And that's what needs to change. We need to Europeanize NATO. And it is fundamental interest of the United States that that succeeds. Now, the driving force is fear of American liability, but that's not going away. Even if Donald Trump goes away, the fear of American liability is a fundamental driving force for European consolidation, Europeanization. And it needs to be in NATO, because it can't be in the EU. Very important European actors are not in NATO. Not only the UK, but Norway. And how do you defend Europe without the UK and without Norway, particularly if the US isn't part of it? And so the EU is not the answer. EU-NATO relations are no longer important, because it's all going to happen in NATO, unless the United States becomes the obstacle and forces the Europeans out of NATO, either because we don't want the Europeanization, or frankly, because we don't want NATO to succeed at all. We want to break it down, which is possible depending on our election result. I think we're in a new era, and the Europeans realizing, when everybody says if Trump becomes president and the U.S. withdraws from NATO, that's the end of NATO. No, it's not. Still an organization with 31 members. And why not use it to defend yourself? Why say, oh my God, we have to do it in the EU? No, you do it in NATO. Much better.
Well, Ivo, we're basically out of time, but I think you really hit the nail on the head there. I mean, it strikes me that for the U.S., we're kind of both stuck between this wanting to maintain the status quo, and then also, the status quo in NATO, which has been great for us, and we don't want anything to change. We call the shots. And then kind of general sense that the Europeans are useless, and that, and the kind of more Trumpian view. And I think there's something I want to say in between, but a new approach is sort of needed on how we think about the EU's role, because the EU is not going to become the combatant command effectively for European security. But it could become the kind of backroom, sort of the role that the services play in the Pentagon, where, they're looking at force strength, they're providing the money and the funding, how many ships do we need to buy, that kind of thing. NATO is directing all of that, but then the EU is then doing the implementation on how to get that done.
I think that's right. I mean, I think, although even on that, you still need the UK, which is not in the EU, be part of it. And by the way, from a defense industrial perspective, British defense industry is pretty darn central to the future of European capacity, whether it's in EADS and the whole slew of things. And by the way, the nuclear component being part of that too. I mean, the French nuclear component is more diversified, but you'd like to have more nuclear weapons if you can't rely on the United States. So all of those reasons are why NATO is going to be operational perspective. But yes, from an economic defense industrial production capability coordination, absolutely, the EU is going to be critical. And the complementarity between the EU and NATO, I think, will be strengthened. In part because the reasons why it's been hard is, Cyprus, of course, Turkey and France, etc. Things are changing. When you think there's a possibility within the next 3 to 5 years of a major war in Europe that affects your security directly, it's already happening. And that's why, again, go back to the beginning, the Ukraine debate won't go away, because it's the same thing about European security as NATO is. But if you're serious about it, you don't play the games that we've been playing for a long time. The only question is, are we serious about it? We, the United States, because that's what the Europeans are starting to ask. And frankly, it's a good question.
Great. Well, Ivo, we're going to have to leave it at there. Thank you so much for joining us on the Eurofile. It's been a fascinating conversation.
My pleasure, as always. Enjoyed it, and look forward to doing this in person at some point.
Yes, we would love to have you in person here at CSIS.
That's it for today's episode. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. You may also be interested in our sister podcast, Russian Roulette, which covers the latest on Vladimir Putin's Russia and the ongoing war in Ukraine. Please also make sure to check out a pretty cool new report authored by Max and colleagues from the CSIS Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program on the impact of Western sanctions on Russia's defense industrial complex. You can find links to all of this in the episode description. Our thanks to our producer, Sean Falk, and to Otto Svensson for coordinating and researching this episode. We'll be back soon with another assessment of Europe through a Washington lens. Until next time.